Thank you, Honorable Acting Chair. My name is Vuselelo Vincent Makakula. I'm a member of this committee from the ANC.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Nonkululeko Tume. I'm a member of this committee. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Ntaliseng Kuno. I'm the Acting Chair and a member of this committee. And really, we'd like to apologize for starting late. There's a problem with the issue. So it was a confusion this morning of members coming out here. That's why we are also late. Can you also introduce yourself?
My name is Naila Abram. I am presenting this morning. I'm a researcher on the gender and health research unit at the Medical Research Council.
My name is Bongwegaz Khatia. I'm also with the Gender and Health of the Medical Research Council. I'll also be presented in the Naima this morning.
Good morning. My name is Yolisa Nogenga. I'm the content advisor of the committee.
Good morning. My name is Siavia Goyana. I'm the researcher for the committee.
Good morning. I'm Moses Ngode. I'm a visitor in this committee. I'm the researcher for the Joint Committee on HIV and AIDS.
Thank you very much for the introductions, and I hope the meeting will go on well and the deliberations will be really good. Without wasting of time, can we go to the briefing by Medical Research Council report? Before we do that, are there any apologies that were tendered for this meeting?
Yes, Jefferson, there are a couple of apologies. One is from Honorable Makuba, who indicated that she wasn't able to be with us today. And another one is from the chairperson. He was unable due to urgent personal matters. One is from Honorable Saba, who attended the Portfolio Committee on Rural Development. There is a legislation they are busy with. And another one is from Honorable Morris. She also attended on women, there's also information before them. Mafolo indicated that she will join us later, and Honorable Bula attended the Committee on Human Settlements. Those are the apologies I've received. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Even though we don't have a quorum, but in the meantime, we don't have anything that we need to adopt. So I think we can just go to the first item on the agenda, which is the briefing by the Research Council. Thanks. Over to you.
Good morning once again. I have an apology from Professor Rachel Jukes. She is very ill and she decided this morning that she could not really fly in. So I will do the whole presentation. Initially the plan was that she will do an overview of our unit to tell you more about the work we do on gender-based violence, and then I and Bongwekazi will do the presentation particularly on intimate femicide. So to start off, our unit, the Gender and Health Unit, is one of 11 intramural units, research units of the Medical Research Council. The Medical Research Council is a parastatal, and our unit in particularly focuses on gender-based violence, and we work in the Southern Hemisphere largely. It's led by Rachel Jukes, that's not here, she's in our A-rated scientist. The two of us started the unit in 1995. We've published extensively in the area of gender-based violence, and we supported research in many parts of the world, not just in Africa, but more recently in China, Papua New Guinea, Sri Lanka, and the Southeast Asia region. Our areas is largely about describing the nature and the magnitude of violence against women, we are trying to understand the impact violence has on the health of women in particular and children. We look at developing evidence-based intervention and responses to gender-based violence. Our focus at the moment is primary prevention, and we also look at the intersectoral responses to gender-based violence, as well, in particularly the criminal justice responses. One particular initiative that we host in our unit is the Sexual Violence Research Initiative. You could go to that website. We've got more than 3,000 researchers and practitioners who work in this field from across the globe and that uses our resources. And so it's a fantastic connection between the researchers. We have just been awarded a different funding. It's 300 million. We're very excited about it. We will lead the work on looking at prevention of gender-based violence across the globe. We will be the managers of this fund, where we will work with people from across the globe in developing evidence-based practices. I'm just showing you what we have done on developing training materials in post-rape care. And then our work on HIV prevention. We developed the Stepping Stones intervention. It's a school-based intervention. Our Shoko is the one we just launched in 18 schools in Gauteng, where it's been tested. Our work clearly is around finding evidence that something works. So we've got a learner workgroup. Children have received it in grade 8. And in only 2 years' time will we know whether this is effective. So research is a long process. We don't always get answers immediately. I want to tell you just very briefly about the work we do internationally. I've done work globally looking at global prevalence of violence against women. This was published in Science. I've also published in The Lancet, where I looked at global prevalence of intimate femicide, the type of violence I'm going to talk about more today. And we also contributed to the development of clinical guidelines for rape victims. And this was developed by WHO, but we had a huge input in it. And then some other work that we've done was that was also published in The Lancet and in BBC, and this was globally acknowledged through the news when this was launched last year. I now want to go specifically into what we are here to talk about, and that is to talk about the work we've done on intimate femicide in South Africa. Let me just maybe let us all understand what we mean by these terminologies, because very often I will talk about intimate femicide and non-intimate femicide, and I'll talk about rape homicide, and I'll talk about intimate suicide, so that everybody understands how we define these terms. Intimate femicide is when a woman is killed by a partner, somebody whom she has had an intimate relationship. It could be a current or ex-partner, husband, a living-in boyfriend or dating boyfriend. When I refer to non-intimate femicide, I refer to a woman killed by somebody who's a stranger, an acquaintance, somebody with whom she did not have an intimate relationship with. Rape homicide or suspected rape homicides are those where there is evidence of a rape that happened. Think of Aline Boyson. She was killed and she was raped. And intimate suicide is where the perpetrator killed himself after he killed the person. And we also look at conviction. Those are people who were either convicted for homicide or culpable homicide after they have been killed. So briefly the background, why we do it. Killing a woman by an intimate partner is probably the most extreme form of gender-based violence. South Africa, we do not have national figures on how big the problem is of gender-based violence in the country overall. And we thought that we should be doing, in 2004 we did the first female homicide study. And this is the first figure nationally of how big the problem is. And so we repeated the study for looking at 2009 data, so it's 10 years apart, looking at the same kind of sampling. In 99, we found that 50% of the women that were killed by a partner, and this relates to four women being killed per day in that was in 1999. However, this is an underestimate because 18% of the women killed in 1999, there was no perpetrator identified. So probably that figure is possibly large. This is what we produced in 99. And that's on our website. This is when we produced the policy brief. Then we did the second study. And we looked at 2009 data. We thought this will allow us to make a comparison between the two studies. We'll be able to see whether there's a shift. We'll be able to see whether it increased or decreased. We'll be able to look at many different aspects of the 99 study. In 2009, we did an additional part. We added children. I'm not presenting the work on child homicide here, but we do have that also in a policy brief and about how the contribution that child abuse makes to children that are being killed was explored in this data set. I'm going to hand over to Bongwe Kazi. She will continue just to tell us about how we did the study.
Thank you, Naima. Obviously, we had to get permission to be able to do this study. Ethical clearance for the study was obtained from the Medical Research Council Ethics Committee, and we also got permission from the National Department of Health and also the Provincial Department of Health so that we can gain access to the mortuaries so that we can collect data. Also, national and provincial South African police services were approached for permission, and we were granted so that we can access police data. The study design, 2009 study design is similar to the 1999 study that we did of female homicide. They were both mortuary-based, and which means that we had to have to access the mortuaries in the country, and we, in our sampling claim, we had to allow for national estimate. Mortuaries were certified based on size, and it was the same for the 1999 study. 38 mortuaries were sampled in 2009. 25 were sampled in 1999. This reflects a change in the services that we have. In 2009 sample, 5 mortuaries were sampled from the large mortuaries, 13 were sampled from the 33 medium-sized mortuaries, and 20 from the 81 small mortuaries. Looking at the map that we have, you can see that here the largest mortuaries were in the urban areas like Cape Town, KZN, and the Gauteng province. You can also see that it's spread in all the provinces of the smaller mortuaries covering the rural areas are there as well. The smaller mortuaries were found in all the provinces. As you can see, the green triangles were spread in the Eastern Cape, KZN, and the Mpumalanga province. Our data collection has three phases. With the first phase where we collected data at the mortuaries, where we had to look at the mortuary register and identify cases and collect data from the register and the autopsy reports. Our second phase, which followed, was collecting data from the police stations. We had to have an interview with the investigating officer of the case or review of the investigating records were done of the cases that we identified in phase one. Our third phase was blood alcohol results from the labs, with the exception with Johannesburg lab, there's still some data that is still outstanding that we have not received. The process of mortuary data collection, it meant that we had to identify cases via the death register, and then mortuary files, including the pathology reports, were checked to verify if the case was a homicide case or not, and if we are unsure, we included it, and then we verified the case with the pathologist or the pathologist's report, and the investigating officer during the interview. There were things that we look at, as you can see there, and also finding the case number and the police station where the case was reported was very important for the second phase of the research, and that was collecting data from the police. The process of police data collection, police data was collected from the police stations and the investigating officers who were responsible for the cases that we had identified. An interview was arranged and conducted with the investigating officer. In a case where we could not get the investigating officer or the IO, we had to interview the commanding officer, or we did a record review, or we were appointed any IO who could help us with that case and who was familiar with it. The information that we collected from the IO included we verified if the case was a homicide case or not. We also verified the victim-perpetrator relationship to establish if it was an intimate femicide. And also we looked at the background of the intimate relationship. We also checked the case outcomes, if the perpetrator was known, if the person was charged or acquitted or convicted. I would like to hand over to Naima to continue with the rest of the
I will present the results now. And the reason why we've given you some information about how we do this, we believe that we can only believe our results if you understand that our methods was credible and acceptable. In fact, our methodology is now being used and in other parts of Europe, in fact, because people really struggle to collect this data routinely. So what did we find? Here I'm showing you a comparison about how the cases were identified. I mainly want you to see that there's a comparison between 99, which is the blue, and the more green-yellow boxes are the 2009 figures. You will see that perpetrator not identified is the second box on the list. The comparison is that in 1999, were about 18% of the cases where murder was committed, but a perpetrator was not found. We hope that this would have decreased, thinking that our police systems have improved and detective systems have improved. But this did not happen. In fact, in 2009, we had 22.9 of the cases where a perpetrator, that's 553 cases where a perpetrator was not found. So I am not able to tell you about those cases because we have no perpetrator, we don't know who killed the woman. Our focus now in the rest of the presentation would be where a perpetrator was identified, and this is in 2009, it was 1,792 cases. We will now look at how these cases were divided into intimate and non-intimate femicide. So, yes, there's good news. Homicide certainly has decreased. Female homicide, the first two bars tells you about female homicides overall, and certainly there's been a decrease. This is consistent. South African police statistics finds this as well, and we expected to find it, and we certainly saw a decrease. If you look at the middle set of bars, this represents the comparison between the decrease in intimate femicide. Yes, there's a decrease, but do you see that the decrease is not as much as the overall, and that concerns us. And if you look at the non-intimate femicide, yes, certainly, again, we see a decrease, but the decrease was the least amongst women killed by the intimate partner. So what does this mean? What proportion, the proportion of women killed among all the women that we identified, where there was the perpetrator, of women killed, what proportion are killed by an intimate partner? In 1999 it was 50%. This increased to 57% in 2009. Now that might be okay because as homicides overall decrease, I didn't say okay, but what I meant is as homicides overall decrease, the proportion of women killed by the partner increases in other parts of the world as well. because the stranger homicides decreases. We're doing better at preventing stranger homicides and criminal acts rather than acts that happens within homes. Globally, this figure is 36.6%. Okay, so we weigh about the global figure in terms of the proportion of the all women killed. This is the research brief I provided you. So before we talked about four women killed per day by intimate partners, and now we talk about every 8 hours, which is three women killed every day by a partner in 2009. If we look at population rates, and why I'm showing you this population rate is because we can compare across populations, and I just want you to focus on how the decrease happened and where it was significant or not significant. Intimate femicide, in 1999 we had 8.8 per 100,000 population. This decreased to 5.6. When we applied statistical analysis to this, this difference was not significant. I want you to look at rape homicides as well. It used to be 3.4, it's now 2.5. Again, that difference was not significant. Then look at gun homicide, the very last one. It used to be 7.5 in 2009. It dropped to 2.5. And that difference, that huge drop, was really significant, and I'll show you more. What I want you to see also, that at the bottom I say the global female homicide rate, the overall female homicide rate, is 2.7 per 100,000. Our overall female homicide rate is 12.9. Our gun homicide rate is 2.5, which is close to the overall one. So we certainly way ahead in terms of the size of the problem compared to the rest of the world. Looking at rape homicides, remember these are the cases where it is definitely a homicide plus is evidence of a sexual assault. In amongst intimate femicide, about 10%, just over 10%, we found in 1999 and 2009 of women where there's evidence of rape. If we look at our non-intimate femicide, something very strange happened in 2009. We see an increase. More than a quarter of the women killed by a stranger or acquaintance were now also, we saw evidence. It cannot be because our forensic pathologists are better at picking it up. Because then it should have been picked up in other cases as well. So there we see a 2.6 greater likelihood of a rape homicide among non-intimate in 2009 compared to 1999. I know I'm talking about gory stuff here, but here you see how women were killed, guns, stabs, and blunt, and are compared for intimate and non-intimate. The most important thing here is to see that your columns for stab and blunt remain reasonably constant and similar between 1999 and 2009. You see a huge difference in guns, and I will show you that in more detail now. The biggest drop, in fact, if we think about the bigger drop of female homicide overall, the contribution comes from a decreased number of gun homicides. So, there was a 50% decrease likelihood for gun-related homicide in 2009 compared to 1999. And you can see that it was consistent amongst the intimate femicide, from 50% to 17%, amongst the non-intimate, the same drop, and among all female homicides. I think it's something that is very dramatic, and it's something that the government should be actually proud of, because they have done something right about gun control to bring about this huge decrease. Convictions, we didn't do as well. We wanted to see convictions increase. Right? We didn't want to see a decrease. There was a slight increase amongst the intimate femicide, but look at the non-intimate femicide. We actually see a decrease in conviction, and that's of concern to us as well. One of the important things that we thought, when we did the 1999 study, we told police that there is a 1 in 2 chance of any woman that's a follow that she's killed by her partner. And we told them that a history of intimate partner violence is important in, as part of their investigation. We found that this has not really increased dramatically. About a third of the police that we interviewed said that they knew that there was a history of intimate partner violence. Then I briefly want to show you about blood alcohol concentrations. Now remember, Bongwe Kazi told you that we do not have all the data for blood alcohol concentrations in the samples that were taken because Johannesburg laboratories are still struggling to retain, to get this all. We're only looking here at Western Cape. So remember, the legal limit is 0.04. Right? We had 62 cases with a positive blood alcohol in 99. We had a similar but a smaller number, 59% of women that were killed had a blood alcohol, a positive blood alcohol. Right? Look at the median. In 99, it was 0.11, not 0.11. It was double that. These women are very strong. When they are killed, and the range, I also want you to look at the range, how the range really shows that this huge amount of alcohol consumption at the time when the killing happened. We obviously do not have the blood alcohol as a perpetrator. That would be a fantastic thing, but this is unfortunately only of the woman that was killed, the victim. Like I just want to you people to see that alcohol certainly seems to play a role creating vulnerability for the woman. She cannot protect herself. She cannot able to... This alcohol was highest amongst the women that were killed by blunt and stab. When women are killed by guns, they're sober. But so when they kill by being stabbed, it really is obvious they don't know when they're in danger and they're not able to protect themselves. So there were challenges in collecting the data in the medical legal system. We found missing mortuary files. We had to try and trace them. When we got to the files, we found missing post-mortem reports, but we had outstanding support from the forensic pathology department who really helped us a lot to try and trace it. Why they are missing, we did not investigate that. We don't know. But a pathology report can be used, obviously, in a case. There were very poorly documented CAS numbers. A CAS number was critical for us, as Bongwe told you earlier, because we had to follow up every case we found in the mortuary with the police station, with the detective. And then there are deaths and accidents. These are women that are were injured badly. They ended up in hospital. And then they only come into the system, in the mortuary system later. So there were really problems, and they are often sometimes not documented in the mortuary system. So these were just things that we have highlighted to the medical forensic pathology department at the Department of Health. Collecting the data at police, again, Bongwe will tell how many headaches we had, missing CAS numbers, as I said, and then we... couldn't find cases. We could not find cases. In the Eastern Cape, there were 77 cases that we had to identify, but there were only 7 available. But the police were fantastic. They found it eventually because we learned from the 99 study how to be good detectives as well. So we worked with them, and we managed to decrease that amount. Similar in Gauteng mortuary, we identify 18 cases, but there are no CAS numbers. So that means there's no case. In fact, we opened cases ourselves with the police. When we found cases where there is obviously a homicide, but we couldn't find a case number, we worked with the police, and it was our ethical duty to make sure a case gets investigated, and those cases were opened. Right, so we still have a challenge around the blood alcohol levels. that's still not completely solved. In conclusion, I want to say that here we have two studies that were identical in survey, 10 years apart, and we have an opportunity maybe to monitor our gender-based violence. Are we doing better at it? Is there a decrease? And we do see an overall decrease in female homicide overall. Intimate femicide, as I showed you, the decrease is not as dramatic, and it is now being killed by your intimate partner is the leading cause of a homicide for women in South Africa. We also maybe here have evidence that work on intimate partner violence and gender-based violence prevention is not really effective. If it had been effective, we should have seen a much, much bigger reduction in intimate female homicide. We, in fact, have seen an increase in rape homicide. That's gender-based violence as well. We have had no evidence that police investigations have improved because convictions have not improved. In fact, it has decreased. But what we have seen is there's been a significant reduction in gun murders. And this provides, I think, the government with evidence that this gun control legislation, despite it being problematic and not being perfect, has been working. We believe this can only be due to gun control legislation. Finally, I want to tell the committee members that we think this is an excellent monitoring tool for gender-based violence responses in our country. We have not gotten it right to do any other monitoring about gender-based violence, but we now have 99 data, we've got 2009 data, and we believe that it should be considered as a monitoring tool to look at whether we are doing well in terms of gaining equity in our gender equity in our country. And we want to recommend that we use this as a tool to measure, and I would say it should be done every 5 years, so the next one should really be the homicide happening in this year, 2014, but we obviously do it 1 year later because all those cases need to go through the police as well as the forensic processes. And we hope that we have funded this from our baseline funding. We know how to do it well, and we would support any government department who has this responsibility to do this in the future. And I think that's the end. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to the NRC. Gender violence is a problem, and it continues to be a problem even now. And I just hope that in our little corners we will make differences out there, and we make sure that together we can reduce this, and maybe we'll achieve more if we work together. The statistics that you have will radically change. I have a few questions, and I see some members. I think I should start with members first, and then I'll go later. Okay. Go ahead, Mark.
Thank you, Chair. I think this you are doing a good job. This gender violence in South Africa is in numbers now. But my question is that the family-related homicide. Are you researching the cause? Are you researching the cause, or you are just researching how many women that have been dead? Because if you are researching the cause, and then you must also come in with an answer. Really, in this related homicide, also on me, I see that maybe we are so gender stereotype. Because also you'll find that even the men are dying on the similar cases and in numbers here in South Africa. And we agreed that also the women. But actually, when you research, are you researching the cause of why this family fighting and end up doing this crucial thing? I just want you to know from your side that are you researching the cause and why you are so gender stereotype or on that level? Because you'll find that even the men, the value of the men that are dying is becoming too high now. And also this rape homicide. I also need to know the reason. Because when they kill brutally. We want to know the reason why they kill brutally. You rape that person, and after you rape that person, you kill. Maybe you rape the child, after you rape that child, you kill that child. And why is the reason? Is that the reason because of this substance abuse? Or the reason because some of them, when we check them, when we asking them in the prison, they said they are worshipping devil. Some they speak very clear when they've been go to the police in custody. They said, no, it's because I'm worshipping devil. You remember this incident that is happening in Cape Town. We find the signs of the person that is worshipping devil. And it happened. You can go even to Crusade. There is an inmate there. Same thing when he killed his old, his grandmother. He said, devil. So we want to know why is that thing? Is that thing really the devil is in this country? And there are people that are worshipping him and killing our women. Also, we also want to know about that thing. Because really it's brutal. After you rape, you killed innocent child or innocent woman. It happened. There was one parolee in Mpumalanga that was a parolee. And then when they come to check, the police came to check him. They find him, he was just masturbation alone. And then the police, they said to her, look, you'll rape because you are doing this thing. They go, they warn him not to do the masturbation. And then after that, when they come, after a week, he raped the neighbor, a woman neighbor, and stabbed. He was one to kill her. So, really also the issue of the masturbation, we have to look why it happened. If there is no women when you are doing that masturbation, because that thing can also control your mind, can lead you to do the wrong thing, and after that you will kill because of you want to hide, or you are killing because of the anger that you have after you did what you want to do is happening. Really, I want also to know from you. Indeed, I can say yes. I was having a friend who was marrying a woman. They only married for a year, not even a year, 6 months, they kill each other. In 6 months, the men kill the woman and buried that woman in the yard. And after that, the man was going to the custody, and then he hanged himself in the custody and died. So really, the cause, it will tell you that this thing, it's something maybe the woman doesn't want to understand, or there is something else with the family doing around them, then we really need to know what is really happening in this country. I thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Magazula. Honorable Mume.
Thank you, Chair. I've got just three questions to ask from the presenter. One, she talked about the training manual that they have. I just want to know if do you share your manuals with your CBOs, your NGOs, or SGOs, both urban and rural, because what you are researching on is happening all over the country, and now it's common in even rural areas where elderly are raped and killed, and there's a lot there. And also in terms of capacity building and awareness to those communities, so that they can be aware of these things. Because at the end, everybody is just shouting about this rape, shouting about this killing, and nothing really is being addressed to come to the solution. And secondly, through your research, does this have something to do with the three challenges that the country is facing, as in now your unemployment, your poverty, and your inequality? Does that, all this rape and killing and murder and what have something to do with the three challenges? So that maybe when we're looking at the solutions, we can also talk based on what the country is experiencing as in now. And the third one will be, I don't know whether I missed something to say, the ages of the victims, maybe, ranges most commonly, they ranging from which age to which age, both in urban areas and in rural areas. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. I think that the issues of violence against women is on the rise, and in fact, I was a little disturbed when I heard that the preventative measures are not effective, and that called for alarming concern. If you take, for example, the preventative measures that need to be put in place to protect the vulnerability of women, my concern is that lots of programs or policy that you tackle the symptoms but not the grassroots problems. Perhaps maybe you could unpack some of your innovative ideas as to what you think could be put in place. It is a clear indication that there is an absolute need for a complete audit on all programs to tackle the symptoms. Some of the concerns may be the issue in and around the erosion of family values, the greater presence of drugs in communities. This is adding to hectic behavior. When you go around, as my colleague has indicated, in constituency, you see these things are readily available in communities. The other concern is, what are your views in and around the issue of unregulated porn industry? This undoubtedly dehumanizes women, and maybe there should be some sort of regulations or something to that effect. Also, the issue of the psychology of men, is that adequate? You know, Madam Chair, not long ago in Chatsworth, in Durban, KwaZulu-Natal, and it was widespread news where this father had, murdered his two children and his wife, and that was an uproar. And then you find that there is this issue about the criminal justice system, and I say this very, very respectfully, that sometimes you have to deal with the issues of technicalities around psychiatric treatment, and on a basis of technicality, the perpetrator is let loose just to create another kind. We also, and it's absolutely important to deal with these issues of, my colleague has touched within the correctional services and the issues in and around parole, that certain perpetrators committing a particular crime, like rape, murder, etc., are let loose within the parole system, and just for a few months to find he or she is back within the cell creating the same crime. These are the symptoms that we need to deal with, and perhaps we need to address that boldly and blatantly. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. It was very informative and interesting, and it's actually very sad to hear the stats that come up from your presentation. I mean, intimate femicide, I hope I've got it right, I mean, affects women in any social class. I mean, and you look at Annie's Boyson and Reva Steenkamp. I mean, two very profile cases. One from a very wealthy background, you know, lived in the poshest area in Pretoria, and the other one from a very disadvantaged background. So it affects women across the board, and by people that they trust and believe and love in many cases. So yeah, I thank you for your research into the matter. I just want to ask a few questions to the notes, to your slide. So starting with slide 14, you say that there's no actual stats from that. So given your research in 99, have you taken this issue up with stats about them recording these kind of murders? And what was the response from stats in that regard? And also linking that to the Domestic Violence Act, because we actually have a brilliant act. It's not implemented well as far as what I've read in the papers. But, I mean, does that act not compel the police to record intimate femicide? If not, maybe someone could look at suggesting an amendment to that, check, if that's not the case. Also, linked to the Domestic Violence Act, on slide 32, you talk about the history of intimate partner violence, and that there is clearly this recorded history. How well is the register being implemented across the country? How did you? Because I mean, if there's a history of violence in the household, I mean, there should have been more proactive measures taken place by the state to prevent it ending up in a death, because ultimately that's where it's going to end up if no interventions happen. So how do you see the register being implemented and used as an instrument to protect from at police stations? Then on slide 23, I'm horrified to see that the number of unidentified perpetrators has increased to nearly 1 in 4, basically 23%. It's extremely high. And while I take it that the actual number has decreased from 1999 to 2009 as far as murders are concerned, and the fact is, given that 23%, it could actually mean that it actually has increased. We don't know, actually. But it's at least 57%, which is horrific, you know, I mean, in itself. So, yeah, then on slide 28, you talk about rape homicides and the fact that for intimate femicides, the amount of rapes the percentage of rapes has dropped from 11.4 to 11, very slight drop. But it's very hard to prove a rape in a relationship. I mean, because the partner could say, well, actually, it was consensual. And, you know, so, you know, yes, we did make love. And then she know it was rape. So that's one of the obstacles you're finding. And if you could just unpack that for us, please. In gun control, it's very interesting to see the drop in the amount of murders committed by guns. And it does show that the law is actually having a positive effect. And it's actually a good cause to call for a gun-free South Africa, quite frankly. I mean, if this is proof of what gun control is doing, you know, one wonders why there isn't a bigger voice calling for gun-free South Africa. You know, so it just shows what positive impact sensible legislation can have. I've talked about the domestic violence register. Then just on the blood, on slide 33, on the amount of alcohol in blood, I mean, it is extremely high. But what have you found in your research with regards to, someone asked a question about underage women or girls being killed by their partners, like we saw with how many of the underage girls are drinking like illegally in pubs and shebeens and taverns and that kind of thing? Because, I mean, there is talk of clamping, you know, bringing in legislation against alcohol advertising and clamping down on illegal establishments. So obviously that would also contribute to a reduction in these kind of murders. And then lastly, Chair, I was shocked to hear that in both the mortuaries and the police that cases were missing or no case number. I mean, that's for murder. I mean, that's actually quite horrific. And you highlighted one province, and I'm sure it's happening in every province. There's probably no exception. You highlighted 77 cases were missing in the Eastern Cape, but you managed to find some. You didn't say how many you found out of the 77, so if you could tell us. And how did you find them? I mean, you have to help the police find them. So what process did you put in place? Because maybe the police could implement your system to find lost cases. And thank you very much.
I'm so interested to find that out. Honorable
colleague. Thanks, Chairperson. My apologies for being late in the meeting. You'll also bear with me if I might ask the questions of something that has been clarified during the presentation, hence I came in the middle of the presentation. But I think maybe before I ask these few questions, I must say that this research seems to going to help us to get exactly the root cause of what we are talking about. The issue of the violence against women and children is an order of the day in this country. You're ending up not wanting to hear anything. You're ending up not wanting to listen to a person who will report to you that there is that case. Chairperson, there is one or two questions that I would want to ask from the presenter that through your research, why there is this decrease of the convictions if maybe you already started researching on it. There is this I don't want to say rumors, but everybody's saying that once there is this high rape cases, it is related to unemployment. I just want to find out, how do you mix the two? If a person is unemployed, what does that make a person to go and rape and kill at the end of the day? Because I would be able to understand if once the person is unemployed, we complain more of the bad luck. And the reason of such, what would be the reason of that person, or if the person is unemployed, he decides to do this. I would want to also to echo what my colleague has been saying earlier on, Honorable Tome, to say you have targeted groups that you want to share this information that you already have through your research, so that the information should be disseminated and inform a number of groups that are at the ground of the society know about the research.
Thank you. I have two last questions from my side. In the absence of a national database, what recommendations are you making to give an advice on government to develop one? Is there any possibility to to expand its database in the meantime? And the studies that you have done, how can you assist the Department of Social Development and other departments involved in victim empowerment and tell us your justice department and all that. The victim empowerment programs are very important to assist victim of crime and gender violence. And one question that the colleagues have asked is that what is the cause really of this? Because I think when we do research, we need to know what is causing this, because we have to find a way to eliminate this, or or make it stable. You know, I remember in 1999 and 2000, I didn't want to watch TV because kids were being raped, they've been killed and all that. In your research, because I don't hear you talking about those kids, the toddlers, the infants that have been raped and died in the process. And kids, you know, children who are under 10 years who've been raped and molested by their parents. Is your research also dealing with that? And the dependence, you know, you find that one of the causes that women tolerate men that beat them every day is because they're dependent on them. And you know, after being beaten every day, they end up killing the women. And I don't know. If in your research you have anything like that, those cases, how many are they and all that. And I really need to know exactly how did you help the police, because the documents, the reports are missing and all that. How did you help the police to retrieve that, and maybe that information you can share with other partners to make sure that at the end of the day, we are able to deal with this problem in the country. Thanks.
Thank you very much for all of this very, very important questions. I'm glad to hear that you did listen to the presentation, because these questions are all very critical. I'll start off with the first lot of questions and I'll go through it chronologically. First of all, it's a presentation many of the ministers on women's are talked about causes of gender-based violence, because addressing the root causes obviously is what is our primary important thing. Now, I did not do, this study was not about, it's about numbers, and it was about the size of the problem and describing it. It was not about why this happened. In other studies, we have looked, and we've done quite a lot of research, as I explained in my first few slides, of the work that we've done on what contributes to gender-based violence. Why does that mean abuse? And we've done it through a number of studies. One of the studies has been that Shanaz Matthews worked on this with us, has actually gone to men in prisons who have killed. And she did qualitative research with them and spoke to them on three or four occasions to try and find out what happened in that relationship. Why did it end up in a killing? What happened just before? And I wish I had time, and if you want, you can invite us again to come and tell you about all the research we have on it. Basically, all those men who eventually killed comes from very, very difficult and harsh childhoods. They themselves have been abused. Now, there is no one single cause of why men abuse and why men use violence. There are a multiple of factors that come together. And that is a multifaceted, it comes from many different aspects. It's our society, it's our structures in our society, it's how women are viewed, it's how people are raised. It is many things contribute. But we've got a few answers. We have an idea of what are the most important factors that you need to intervene with. And that's why I showed you those interventions to realize that we need, if we talk about prevention, we do need to start with families and people operate. It's about building resilience in families and not using violence from very early on. Discipline, positive discipline. So I'm afraid it will take me quite a long time to talk through the causes that we've come across and that globally people have come across, because it's very similar in other parts of the world. The root causes of violence are very similar. But those are what we need to understand in order to develop the intervention. Okay, so I, unfortunately, we have got it, and I can recommend where you can go and read up on it. There's some excellent, very basic work that has been done on the primary causes of which are the factors that lead you onto a pathway but I just want to emphasize it is about the perpetrator's childhood, Lord Jesus. It's about his childhood. Then the other question that you ask about is, you ask why rape in particular. Now, we've done a study where we spoke to men in KwaZulu-Natal and Eastern Cape about how often they rape and who they rape and why they rape. And one of the questions is they're bored, they find it entertaining. That's one of the reasons. It's a form of entertainment for them. Young group of young boys go off and look for something to do, and raping a girl and finding a girl is one of those things. And that I can share with you people as well. It's been a report. We can come and present it to you as well. But that told us a lot around why boys enter eventually, and it's the main causes. It's not about wanting to prevent HIV and looking for that's one of the myths that's going around. Men didn't say it was that. It was mainly around, and the other thing is they punish women. Women who they might have proposed to a girl and she might have declined them, and so a way of punishing them is that thing. So I wish I had more time, but we have got in South Africa, like I showed you right at the beginning, we have done extensive work that is in fact being used outside of our country to develop interventions to prevent rape and to prevent gender-based violence. Again, I can't answer a question on masturbation, about why it happens. I think there is some research that's talking about masturbation in a young child shouldn't be so completely acted on as it's wrong, because it might be a developmental thing when children are young. That it's a natural thing that children enjoy and find pleasure out of it. But as children are getting older and they continue to masturbate, that's when it's problematic. But I don't have the whole answer about exactly how masturbation contribute. Somebody asked about pornography. I think it was you. Yes, there's evidence. I just want to link the masturbation and the pornography. There is clearly evidence that exposure to pornography and the need to use pornography, which can lead to masturbation, really increases the men who does that and are exposed to that are more likely to rape as well. So again, there is your causal pathway. And yes, porn material can be a contributing factor. I hope I answered your questions there. The second lot of questions, the first one, you talked about the manuals that we produce. It actually belongs to the Department of Health. We produced it for them, and it was their role to use it and to do the training. We've done a training in a couple of provinces, and this one particular manual you talked about, the training manual, is for sexual assault service providers. So these are the Tutuzela people, and the training was mainly around training people to be caring towards rape victims. We have found that women are very often, and boys are treated harshly, and we think if their experience when they enter the Tutuzelas are a caring experience, it makes such an impact on their feelings later. So that's available. Please go and ask the Department of Health why they are not using it. We are a research organization. We do not implement programs. We do not we disseminate our information. And in fact, this femicide study about a year ago, 1.5 years ago it was released, and we have consistently, we released it first to the police and to health, and we had a number of sessions with important stakeholders where we released it later too. So we have tried and made effort to share this with everybody. You also asked the question, Minister, about the factors that contribute to poverty, inequality, unemployment. Yes, but in fact, I told you about the study with the men where they were asked about whether they rape and who they rape, and we looked at who are these men that But they're not the unemployed men actually only. They are men that actually have got some money. They are men who actually have got money maybe to attract a young girl in a bar, buy her a drink. So they're not very, very poor. They're actually starting, I suppose it's young men that are starting to have money, they have a job, and they are, want to demonstrate their masculinity and have many girlfriends and being attractive, and being a man is having sexual relationships. So unemployment certainly is not one of the primary. It does contribute, but we've also found that employed men, men who have a list, not a lot of money, not men who have loads of, but it's those that are just starting to have money. But please, I can share that with you. It's got lots of value there. The second, lots of questions you asked around prevention measures, and you said you were concerned that the responses or the work that we're doing in South Africa is not evidence-based. And yes, that is sad. And we feel that is our role, and that's why we're doing this intervention, but we're basing it on what works. There are many, and I think our government are doing lots of media, lots of responses. There are things that they're doing, but I don't know, we don't know if what they're doing is based on whether it works. Do we know whether things work? And that's why we're doing these interventions now at school. We've done Sticking Stone, an intervention that was done in school. It showed that it decreased violence amongst the young boys. Nobody's taken that up. It was developed in South Africa, the only place where it was developed. Internationally hailed, other parts of the world are using it. We in South Africa have not taken up Sticking Stone as a prevention tool. It's available. We have got it, we tested it, it's proven to work. And it's on our website, everybody can use it to share it with people. Audit of interventions, you talked about that. There is going to be a report that's going to be released by the Department of Women, Children and People with Disabilities. The report is similar to the HIV report, it's called Know Your Epidemic, Know Your Responses. And it should be out soon. If it is released by them, we work on it. And in there, not the audit, but for the very, very first time, we have got a list of all the responses to gender-based violence in the country, whether it's justice, social, health, and NGOs. So there is a start. I hope I'm answering your question. The next one was from Minister Walters. You asked about SAPS and the South African police, and whether we can the recording of the perpetrator. We have since 99 data. We have been going to them and said we don't need to do the study. If you people are able to document, have in your filing system a tick next to it whether the perpetrator is a partner. Now, there are systems in place like this in other parts of the world, obviously developed parts of the world, like the US and the UK. That's not really, that's also a number of homicides, not as many as us. But our police are saying they don't always know immediately. So that file on the computer is normally uploaded right at the beginning, and nobody really goes back to it. So it needs to be a system where it gets uploaded and somebody needs to maintain it. And the police officers, the investigating officers do not see it as their role. So that's why we need to interview them, because that information sits in their files and it's not on the system. Another way to deal with it, and it's one that we recommended, and Madam Chair, you talked about the recommendation, is to have a death review of all women that are killed. So like they're doing maternal reviews and child death reviews, you have a review of all the women that were killed, say, and that came through self-abortion. and a group of people sit together and they make sure that this case goes to conviction, the case file doesn't disappear, and this gets recorded as a case. That's another way. We are starting one, we're testing one with children at the moment, with the Children's Child Health Institute. So that's another way of doing it, is to look at this, homicide in the children. Linking it to the Domestic Violence Act, because the Domestic Violence Act, I almost want to say, works with live bodies, with people that are still alive. When a woman dies, it doesn't go, that act doesn't really in any way get connected. You also asked about the history of intimate partner violence. And that we could only get from the police officer. When we asked him, do you know whether there was a history of violence in that relationship? And he will only know that answer if he did, if he asked her family, or if he went and looked up whether it was recorded as a domestic violence case and whether the woman had a protection order against him. But there is no link. It's only if he's clever enough or she's clever enough to go and look for it. But there is no link, really.
What she's saying, I mean, practically, if a woman is murdered, she has an ID number, which gets put into the system with a case number. One would think that would be automatically linked to the domestic violence register. If, I mean, this is my thinking, right? Because if I've had a protection order against my partner, my details would be on the register, my ID number. And therefore, so you're telling me there's no link with anything?
No.
Wow. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Certainly not. I think you also made reference to the perpetrator's unknown about whether that is more or less. And then you made a very important comment that, well, I think if we do a third series of the study, we will see a trend, and then we will be able to establish. Now, a very important question was asked, how do we know it was a rape and not just a sexual interaction that was consensual? We know. We're aware of it, that that is problematic, and that's why we call it suspected rape homicide. What we did is the forensic pathologist identified whether there were semen. There is always the police officers would document whether the woman, and the forensic pathologist will also, if they're good, they do an examination of the vagina and they see if there's tears and whether a sexual intercourse has happened. Some is very clearly a rape because the woman is also injured in some other way. But yes, we do know if it's an intimate, whether that can be considered as a rape. But I think we can consider it because the woman was killed. There is some conflict there. There was some conflict. But we accept the fact that it's always a suspected rape homicide because the woman has died unless the perpetrator stands up in court and he says, yes, I raped her. Then we can confirm. So I agree and we know that and we report it as suspected rape homicide. The alcohol in the blood, underage drink. Oh, right, yes. I don't know the answer about underage drinking. I have not looked at the data in that way. Somebody asked about the age of the woman that was killed. They were mid-30s. The average age of the woman was 34. The woman killed by a non-partner was older. They were 40. But we do have a group that's younger because the age of the woman in our date and our study starts at the age of 14. So we have got data of woman 14. I also told you about the child homicide. I've not reported it here. I think you asked about it. But there we've got information about all children 0 to 18 years old and whether they've been raped as well.
well. Bread data is available. So I think that would be a very interesting analysis to do if we get all the alcohol analysis, is to look at the people under the age of 18 and what was the level of alcohol. Well, probably I haven't thought about it, but it will maybe contribute to the whole lobby for not selling of alcohol to children under 18. The decrease in conviction, I don't know. No idea why that happened. I have no idea. We would love to remember. We just measured and looked at it, but we did not we don't understand why. I told you about dissemination of the research. And then lastly, your bit of questions was about a database and about developing a database. I think I explained how I think we should really, if we develop a review system, we develop a database as well. That would be all part of it. We then able to regularly, every month, we'll be able to know how many women were killed, and we ease that investigation in the process. It will impact on the investigation also, and maybe impact on, just like the Tutu Dallas are doing with the rape, so we should be really following up women that are killed, as well as children. You ask about children. I'm not presenting the children here, but yes, are we starting that kind of review with children? Finally, you ask about what can social development do and the VEP program, empowerment program. I think we do need to focus on families. We cannot tackle this problem. It's a big problem. We're not going to see overnight a difference. And I don't know if we're going to see it immediately in the next 10 years, but we cannot think that the problem is too big to handle. And I think we need to really work with we need to focus on prevention. I almost want to say, and this is really sad, that the men who perpetrate and that are in the system already, and they're sitting in prisons already, I don't know what the value would be in trying to rehabilitate them and how effective that would be. But shift and take our monies to children and to families and build families and assist families in helping their children. So that is our current work. That is the thought internationally. When people are thinking internationally, the whole shift is towards assisting vulnerable families and assisting children. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Abrahams. Ms. Rabia, is there anything that you want to add?
Yes, there was a question on how we
okay, thank you. With the police cases, oh gosh, it was a tedious job, because in the Eastern Cape, you found that there were a lot of cases which didn't have case numbers. Obviously, we got those from the mortuaries, but they would have them at the police station. So if we had to speak to the higher people, so we were lucky in that case where we could be able to get those cases like that. And like Naima did say initially that in some we had to even open up cases, because yes, we go to the mortuary, we find that there's a case of a woman who has been murdered, there's no case number, and we had to find out how did that happen, and that meant that we had to open a case if ever there's a case that was not open. I don't know if you want to add more to that.
Yeah. I think it was about getting the managers to enforce it on the investigating officers of those police stations to open cases and to find those cases. What happened, it was about the police station. If a woman died in a certain area but she lived somewhere else, and it's about where the case was initially reported. So very often a case is reported somewhere else
and the investigation happened somewhere else. So it was trying to link it and to bring it to one single person, because I think it was running around between police stations also that happened. But the support eventually that we got from the top management really helped us. They went with us to police stations eventually, because we'll go to the police station, they'll say, there's no case, there's no such case. And then we take the pathology report, and we show them there's a document, and eventually we had to place the picture. We should maybe write that all up, the whole process. But we reported back to police about that in detail, yeah, to each province.
Are there any additional questions?
Thank you. Just a comment. I mean, I've got a great concern, and I'm sure other members do as well, that not all murder cases have a case number. And it's irrelevant if the murder is recorded in one police station as opposed to another, because it should be on the system. It should be, you know, that's what, ideally, I'm talking about ideally now. I know it's not a cliche. So you wonder, with the stats of murders coming down, how accurate it actually is, if not all murder cases are actually recorded. And one would think that with murder cases, it would be the most accurate, because you have a physical body. Do you know what I'm saying? So there should automatically be a murder case, or a case number, as opposed to housebreaking, or rape, or assault, or whatever the case may be. So it is very concerning, that, Chair. And the other concern is what I've raised as well, is the fact that cases aren't updated and aren't linked to the domestic violence register, that the systems don't seem to be talking to each other in SAS. And maybe as a committee we should invite SAS to come along and maybe explain to us how their system works and how they're going to improve it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I didn't get an answer about those who kill women and children and say they are worshipping devil.
I'm sorry that I missed that one.
You respond. The definition of gender is not only women. It's also men. So when you say gender violence, and there are several questions that you posed earlier on about men who are being killed by women. And I maybe it's not part of your research, but I just want to find out from you what are you doing. Because when we say gender, it's both men and women.
I'm sorry,
I
didn't the causes and the one that you particularly talked about in terms of the devil. Like I said, our study did not look at the reason why they killed. We only looked at who the perpetrator was, and by that we assumed it was an intimate partner femicide. Now, I am aware that there is talk that that people who commit crime talk about them not being responsible, it's because they are told, and but I have not heard of it. We've not studied it, we've not looked at it in detail, we've not come across it a lot. What we have come across is witchcraft killing, which is not the same thing. In our data set, I'm just trying to make sure I've got the right number in my head. We found that there were older women that were killed, and sometimes the police are able to tell us what they think were the underlying cause of that killing, and witchcraft came up. I haven't got the number in my head. It wasn't a huge number. It was being either 11 or 13 of the cases in 2009 where police were able to tell us this is related to witchcraft related killing. So that's the only. I'm sure witchcraft killings and being devil related killings is not the same, I think. So I'm not sure I can say it's the same thing. I hope that that helps you understand. The second thing, and I'm sorry I missed the issue about men being killed by women. Our study, when we talk about gender and gender-based violence, we define gender-based violence as violence that happens because of the person's gendered position, mainly the woman's gendered position, okay, as a social position. And that's why when we talk about it, we mainly talk about it in terms of women being the victims in gender-based violence. Men in our country, yes, are victims of violence in a very, very big way. Most of our homicides are not female homicides, it is male homicides, and particularly young men. But they kill each other not because they are in intimate relationships. They normally, it's usually acquaintances and acquaintances and strangers. When it's men on men killing each other, that dynamic is different. Gender is not the primary underlying construct, and that's why we cannot call it gender-based violence. Now, we did not look at, yes, I do agree, men are also killed by the intimate partners, so they're killed by the woman. We did not look at that. Globally, however, when I was part of the global study, they were able to collect that from countries where it is collected, like the UK and USA, and that sits between 4 and 6% of all men that are being killed, between 4 and 6% of all men that are being killed globally are killed by intimate partner, compared to 36.6% of all women that are being killed are killed by an intimate partner. That is the global figures. So yes, it happens, but the scale is quite different. But we don't know what it is in South Africa. We've not done that yet. I hope that answers your question and the question around gender. Yeah.
Romana and Honorable Bula. Thank you. No, it's just a comment and a concern as well with regards to a case that does not have case numbers at police stations while there is a matter. My understanding is that once there is this matter, there should be a case number. An inquest should be opened so that the case number should be available. So that tells us there is a serious problem. That SAPS sometimes can just take a matter as something that is like, it can happen, but a person can die, because even if there is no one that is being suspected as a person who has been killed, but I think there should be a case number. So I will also say, maybe you'll also assist in continuously researching as to why there is this matter, but there is no case number, to assist us as to maybe the person that has already suspected and not been caught is somebody that has a relationship or known by the police, or maybe they're ignoring just because they don't want the person to be caught and brought in for the case, to face the cases. Maybe the research can assist us, but it is a concern. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on the very same note, you spoke about missing reports and those kind of things. And we speak, abundantly about moving away and going green and all of those kind of things. I think it will be very wise. I think we speak about this biometric screening in social development, etc. We spoke about this time and again about the Department of SHGS, the Department of Justice, etc., be aligned and synchronized. So maybe if we move away from manual documentation and go on to have the documents cleaned and saved on a disk and all of that, it will help to alleviate that kind of problem. But Madam Chair, thank you very much. I was very humbled to hear that you have acknowledged that there's something wrong with the programs, and we need to address that accordingly. Perhaps maybe you need to actually maybe work very closely and zoom in with the correctional services and to find out what is happening with the rehabilitation programs, even with the drug centers and the rehabilitation centers, whether the dosage and the medication, etc., has been working, so that we can prevent this hectic behavior amongst communities, even if people are rehabilitated. Thank you, madam.
Gender violence is a problem, and I think it's a societal problem we all need to have a say in doing something to make a difference. And I hear that you are a research council, which is why you're here and all that. That's your main thing. But I think with the experience that I have in politics, I know that there's nothing that can be solved without coordination. You are already working with the SAPS. You are already working with Department of Justice and other people. But do you have a forum where you say maybe after a year or so, here are the findings that you have made. What is it that you can do? I mean, if you can reduce some numbers, the gun killings and other things that you can do, you cannot reduce that alone. There's an effort that you spoke to somebody and you came together. This is a problem. What can we do to solve it? So what we are saying is that you need to have forums where you are able to come together and say, this is what I have done, what is it that you can do to make sure that at the end of the day, we reduce these numbers. And because, I mean, the database that you have now, or the data, or what you try to get, it's not like you check all mortuaries, all police stations and all that. It means if you do that, there will be more numbers and all that. That's why I'm saying it's a serious concern. But we need to be doing something. And I think as researchers, you cannot just research and make findings. There's something that you have to do. And I think some of the things that you need to do to coordinate, come together and see what you can do to reduce.
Thank you very much for that. I think it is, we oftentimes think, how does our research get used? How is our research of value to government and to making a change? And we think that forums like these, coming to present this, is critical. You, the policymakers, and we need to be talking to the people that can bring about change. We can give you the ammunition, the information, the data for you to fight the cause. The important thing is, who is responsible for gender-based violence prevention in our country? That's the primary question. And who is primarily responsible for developing a plan? It's a complicated problem, and it should be a complicated plan. But where is that plan, and how is it being monitored and implemented? That clearly is what needs to happen, is to a very, very clear plan about responding to gender-based violence in this country. I have no idea who leads. I mean, we know that there is a council now, but I think it's a monitoring rather than an implementation function. And I think we need to work together to develop a very clear plan and responsibilities and money and resources placed at it, because it's far too ad hoc and bits and pieces rather than a holistic comprehensive plan. So I hope that happens in the future.
Thank you very much for the presentation and the responses of the questions that we have. And I hope that besides coming to this meeting, we make use of our constituency offices, because, as I said, it's a societal issue. We need to see how we take it together. And thank you so much. And now, members, we have a second item on the agenda, and we have to adopt the draft committee report on the oversight to housing. So I think we need one more member. Okay, if you want to stay, you can stay, but you are excused. Okay. So members, did you get? Huh?
We need 7 members. So can we adjourn and have tea in the meantime when I was trying to get another member to come and join us? Thank you.
Yes, Baba.
What is happening? Sorry, so I'm getting it.
What's going on?
I'm a virus. Oh, okay. I'm a popular. Yeah. Have you got candidates?
Yes, you know, I'm asking. Today I'm going to watch Blood and Inception on the night of the candidates for 2020. You'll take one day. You'll take the 49, I think.
You're going to take one?
No, you.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did you send me? No, it's the party.
Yeah, we've got some candidates. We'll take some votes. But I'm not that naive to see this happening in the ANC. For the auntie to get in before she comes. I can see that. So they appointed me to look at the by-election, come up with tactics. From the 100% tactics that I would use, I gave them 10%. So then I can look and hire a political, what you call that?
Analysis.
Pay $100,000.
So, but this is my concern.
But there's only reason why I am going to try and say the DA is mayor of Canada. You can let the DA down. And the jobs we hire at the ANC. Can you trust the DA or the ANC to manage to make your home the ANC?
Okay.
What I can do?
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand.
Yes.